Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 6, delivered on September 7, 2017. The title of this lecture is Financial Ratios.
Today, financial ratios. Let me start out with a quick, madam, suggest a public company. Apple. Going big time, huh? Actually, let me check something with Apple real quick here. There might be a reason why I wouldn't use it for this lecture. I'm not sure if Apple pays a dividend. And one of our ratios will be the dividend ratio. But let me check real quick here. I really feel kind of trashy going to this site, finance.yahoo.com, but for quick little piece of information, Apple, AAPL, we get our trading symbol there. Now, I'm going to bring up something real quick here before I go on. Okay. Sorry. Oh, they do pay a dividend. My bad. What company is it I'm thinking of that doesn't pay a dividend? There are a couple of huge ones that don't. But they have, first things first, dividend ratio. It's just the dollar dividend per share divided by the price per share. That's all it is. Essentially, that's like if I buy Apple stock at $161.65, $161.63, hey, I got a bargain. I'm going to bank on two ways to make money. One way is that the stock price will go up and I can sell the stock at a higher price. That's called the capital gain. But if a company pays a dividend, then I'm going to have more like a guarantee of at least some income. And so I put $161.73 in, and every year I'm going to get a $2.52 dividend out. So that's sort of like the second way is through the dividend yield. The capital gain yield would be price I sold it at minus the price I bought it at divided by the price I bought it at. The dividend yield is the dividend I get divided by the price I get for it. So that's one of our ratios, and I'll bring that one up. By the way, I've put up on your resources tab in ReggieNet, there's a financial ratios sheet for you. Did I bring that up? Oh, there it is, yeah. Here's a sheet. You might want to laminate it and carry it with you everywhere for the rest of your life, or put it up on the refrigerator so your friends can see how cool you are, or not. Okay, maybe not. But that's up there for you to have a look at. Something before I go any further, and I probably brought this up before, but I will again. If I give you two or three or four letters, that is almost certainly, especially if they're in caps, that is almost certainly a trading symbol for a company. So I could give you a K. If I say K, you don't say, okay. No, you say, Kroger. If I give you a I'm trying to think of a two-letter trading symbol, but they are out there. But if I give you one like for example, a three or four-letter, a three-letter would probably be a big company trading on a major exchange. A four-letter would be a NASDAQ stock. Some of those can be big, but those can be small too. So, for example, if I looked up NFLX, if I say NFLX, you know right away I'm calling a trading symbol. So don't be confused if I were to say, I want you to investigate something like SBUX. You would know right away that I was giving you a trading symbol. That's going to be very important at the end of this lecture because I'm going to give you a trading symbol. And then your job will be to go home this weekend and do a test, a quiz on it. That's an in-class quiz for me. I give you the information in class that's necessary, and then from there, you in class know what to do to get the information to answer the quiz questions. You'll get two shots at this quiz, and there's no time limit on working on it. Because sometimes it takes a while, you want to double check your work and all that. But that's how this is going to work. At the end of this lecture, I'm going to give you some letters. And if you know what I'm talking about, then you know where to go to get the information to do this. Okay, so in this case, I called APPL, and that's Apple. And I see very quickly just a few things to highlight here. Market, first of all, the bid and the asks. This is what you would sell it at. This is what you would buy it at. See, there. I'm trying to just confuse you. There. See, there's yours. Okay. Whew. Okay. Right now, 161.37 to, yeah, trade. It's in the middle of the trading day, so you're going to see things flipping around on me. This is what you could sell the stock at. This is what you could buy it at. The day's range is, in this case, very narrow. This is, I don't really care about the dollar amount. It's about a dollar and a quarter is the trading range. What really matters is that that's a tiny up and down movement. This is moving at a very tight trading band today. And the 52-week range, though, now that is a little more interesting to me. Tell me, if you were to, just looking at this straight up, is this stock, where is this stock today relative to its 52-week trading range? What is the stock price today? Look at that giant number up there. $161 and a couple of three quarters, something like that. Okay, so look at the 52-week range of prices from what was its low over the last year? What was its high over the last year? So is this trading near the top or the bottom of its? Okay, that's important. It's trading near the top of its 52-week range. A technical analyst would say, okay, that's interesting there because that means that the stock right now is testing its top. The traders are pushing on the top of it. Old school rule of thumb. You look to see if a stock breaks its neckline on the top or the bottom. Right now, the market is barking at the top. It's looking at the top of that hill. It's close to it, but it's not sure that it wants to go through it. If it bounces off it, just a rule of thumb, bouncing off it three times, if it tests the high but doesn't break the neckline three times, that's not a good sign. So we're going to keep an eye on this, see how we would keep an eye on this and say, all right, let's see if this thing can stop barking at that peak and go over that. And it looks like it's trying, but it's just kind of working on it. Kind of arguing with it right now. The same is true on the bottom. You look at the lower. If this stock were trading at 105, I'd say, all right, it's trying to test the bottom. If it just keeps going down but it doesn't cut through the lower neckline, I'm going to say, okay, it's not as scary as it was. That might be a buy signal. The market tried three times to break the neckline on the downside. It didn't, so that means it's a bargain and it's probably not going to break that neckline. This is not advice. This is I'm just telling you how we used to do this back in the day before all of the charts and the computers and all of that kind of stuff. We looked at necklines as a good indication of what the market sentiment is, whether the market is scared or not. Right now, the market is, this is a down day, but look at the percentage, and that's what really matters. See, that's a tiny percentage down. Now, there's more information here that I'm going to probe on you. I'm going to ask questions about this as time goes on. in in-class quizzes and possibly on your written exams. Volume, well, see, we're in the middle of the trading day, so we can't really tell. But it looks like the volume right now is pretty light on the stock. I can't really say that, though, but because, I mean, we're still in the morning. The bell isn't that long back in the past hours, so I don't know. I can't really tell you much about the volume. But know this. When you see that number, volume, that is on balance volume, OBV. What we now have, something that is a little bit newer, and I've talked about this a bit, now I can show you some numbers and talk about it some more, are dark pools. On balance volume are the trades that are on the open limit order books. In other words, what is visible to everybody. We all see each other's limit orders, who's buying at this price, who's selling at this price, and all that. However, a fairly deep market of dark pools is now out there. The limit books are not transparent. They're not there. So there could be volume that is just, we're not seeing it at all. And that could be significant. And it can sometimes pop up to the surface. And, well, gee, how did that happen? Oh, there was something happening under the surface we couldn't see in the dark pools. And then finally it shows up in the light and we're surprised by it. Okay, now, market cap. Market cap is merely the number of shares outstanding times the price per share. It is the market's assessment of the value of ownership, total value of ownership, the total stockholders' value in the corporation. The book value is what is on the stockholders' equity, total stockholders' equity line on the balance sheet. That accounting line is meaningless, absolutely meaningless. It is a product of hard work and a lot of calculations by accountants, but what matters is what the market has decided the value of ownership is. The value of ownership in this corporation is $834.5 billion. Not too far from $1 trillion in one corporation. That should actually kind of disturb you. This is larger than some nations. You and everyone in this room, everyone in this town, everyone in this state are irrelevant as far as value goes compared to Apple. We've let this happen. There were laws that tried to keep it from happening past a century or more ago. We stopped worrying about it. Now these companies have become so large that they can shape the nations of the world. That's why in a lot of ways in finance, we do concern ourselves with nations, but anymore, really what we care most about as far as the future of the world goes are what are called economic spheres of influence. These powerhouses, these giant megalithic corporations, these coordinations of companies and their owners. That's where we are now, in a world where we have these giants and all of us are rats trying to survive in it. The beta, big stuff. I'll talk a lot about it in this course, and eventually I'll get to the point where I can show you how to use it in calculations. But know this. A beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a company, of a stock relative to the market portfolio. Beta measures the non-diversifiable risk of a stock, actually a security, relative to the market portfolio. In other words, a beta of one would have exactly the non-diversifiable risk of the market. There is a lot more risk. There are two kinds of risk. One, you need to get rid of. You're not going to get rewarded for it. The one we care about is the non-diversifiable risk. That is the risk that survives our efforts to mitigate risk. The non-diversifiable risk is the one we key on. We consider that a beta of a stock above one is higher risk, a beta than the market. A beta below one is a stock that has a risk that is lower than the market. And when I say risk, all I'm talking about is the risk you can't get rid of, the non-diversifiable risk. So in this case, we're looking at Apple, which has a non-diversifiable risk of 1.43. It is, therefore, sir, yes. In matter of fact, once you get above about 1.2, 1.3, you're beginning to get into a pretty daring position. Now, you put together a portfolio of stocks. If you're on your own, you can do whatever you want. You can be stupid or smart. But if you're dealing with other people's money, you're a manager of money, you are interested in your portfolio in a pension plan or something like that, you look at the portfolio's beta, which is just the weighted average of the betas of its components. In a stock like this would be, if you want a portfolio that had a beta of, let's say, 1.4, you're a risk-taking investor. Traditionally, we considered that someone who looks really, really young. Yeah, okay. You would be we might see you or advise you to have a portfolio beta above one. Because you could win big, but you could also lose big. But at a young age, you can recover if you lose. Okay, that's the theory. And as we get people into their more responsible years, when they have a family to take care of, when they're working toward their retirement, we would expect to pull the beta back on the portfolio. We wouldn't be putting Apple into a portfolio because we would want, someday you will be old, wrinkled, no friends, like me. I hang a pork chop around my neck so my cats will like me, okay? So the point here is that we pull back because we can't let you have too high a risk, because if you lose a lot with a high-risk portfolio, you're going to be eating my cat's food. I'm not going to let you in my house. No. Get away from me, you old woman. So we would pull back that beta on the portfolios as the people get older. You hear that your girlfriend. She says those sweet words to you that change your whole life. I'm going to have a baby. Yeah, I know, right? Rule one, don't say whose is it. Okay, seriously, noob. I mean, that the pain is not worth it. You are going to be a daddy. Uh-huh. God help that child. Now, that's what everyone said when I said I'm going to be a daddy. Turned out they were right. Boy, those kids are messed up. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at here, though, is that once that happens, you're going to pull that beta back. Now, we're still going to have to invest somewhat aggressively because you've got to plan for a house. You're going to have to plan for education. You're going to have to plan for the drug rehab for the kids and all that kind of stuff. I know, yeah. So the point of this is, though, that it's not just an either or. We're moving the portfolio beta responsibly through time. And if you are a prudent person, having those responsibilities and you recognize, okay, I got to be a little bit less of a party goer and all that kind of stuff, you will begin to notice, okay, I've got a portfolio I've been building. Let's keep an eye on the beta. Now, you're not trading beta every day. Buy and hold is how you play the market. But you also, over a period of time, because of your status, life status, and also the economy itself, you will move the beta around somewhat, adjust the portfolio, what we call rebalance the portfolio. This is the whole thing, one of the things we do in our work. And if you are interested in this kind of stuff, financial planning is definitely a place for you. Stock trading is a place for you. Wealth management. These are the places where you begin to think about how these portfolios are constructed. And then you take courses from me or some of our other great professors here in portfolio control theory. We even have a course, if you're interested in it, we have a course where, two courses where you invest real money, lots of real money. You work in teams through the semester, and you get to network with all of these fancy people who are the trustees who keep an eye on you, and you learn how to do this kind of stuff. We have a financial planning program here now, too, if you're interested in that, talk to me about it. But anyway, enough of that. P.E. ratio. This is the price to earnings, the price per share over the earnings per share. Oh, that's supposed to be silent. Shut up. I thought I turned that up. I got an app that's supposed to turn it off at certain times of the day, and it's not working. Earnings per share. Okay, here's what this does. The company has earned, let's say, $100 per share. In other words, the total earnings divided by the number of shares outstanding. Now, we take the price per share divided by the earnings per share, and what we see is how many dollars the investors are willing to pay for every $1 the company has brought to the bottom line for them now. Think about it this way. The company has pulled off, let's say, a dollar in earnings that belong to you. Now, they can invest them or give them as a dividend. That's beside the point. They've made it to the bottom line. You, as a shareholder, have $1. There were a bunch of shareholders divide. The earnings were huge, but they divide by the number of shareholders. You have a dollar. Now, someone comes in and says, that dollar of current earnings, I think that's going to create, as a present value, $12 in the future. For every dollar the company has made for you now that it can reinvest or give as dividends, the company is going to be able to create 12 more dollars off that over time. That's the P/E ratio. It simply is a measure of how much investors believe that each dollar of current earnings is worth in future earnings. How much each dollar of current earnings is worth to create future dollars. So when I look at Apple, I see a P/E ratio of 18.34. That's saying that for every dollar Apple brought to the bottom line that belongs to the shareholders as residual claim, this company is going to be able to create 18 more dollars for those shareholders as a residual claim. It's an old school number. Here's what we look at. We look at it like this. The higher that number is, the more risk there is in the stock. The company, the investors at $18, they're saying every dollar of shareholder earnings, of what belongs to shareholders, that Apple has just earned, the market thinks that the company is going to be able to create 18 more dollars. Now, the higher that number is, the more investors are willing to pay for a current dollar of earnings. So it is a measure of how risky it is to invest in this. A P/E ratio, it used to be we were worried when P/E ratios got above 10 to 15. Now an 18 doesn't make anyone blink. Back in the crazy days, you saw P/E ratios of 100, 200. There was a stock on the Nikkei index that had a P/E ratio of 20,000. 20,000. They were willing to pay 20,000 yen for claim on 1 yen of current earnings. That's insane. That's... So beta is the is the academic, scholarly, technical measure we use. But we still, to this day, keep an eye on that P-E ratio. The P-E ratio, interestingly enough, I'm looking at Apple, and the P-E ratio is somewhat inconsistent with the beta. That P-E ratio looks a little lower as far as risk goes. I mean, the two, if I were to look at which one I should believe, I'd probably look at beta. But at the same time, I have a little bit of an interest in the fact that this P-E ratio of Apple isn't all that big. I'm going to take you to another screen here in a minute and show you another one. But here's your dividend, $2.52 a share. Now, you divide that by $1.62 and 0.04, $162.03, and you get 1.55%. That is the dividend yield. The dividend yield, this was the P-E ratio. The dividend yield is the dividend per share divided by the price per share. It's your essentially your yield on your savings account if your savings account is Apple stock. The two parts of how you make money. Total yield on a stock is the dividend yield plus the capital gain yield. Now, the dividend yield is right there. The capital gain yield is sell price minus buy price over the buy price. In other words, how much you make on the stock. Actually, that's a little bit too simplistic because you probably have to annualize the yield unless you bought it, sold it exactly one year after you bought it. But it's enough for us for right now. Now, Apple's target is... I don't know who projects this. It could be some genius of finance, or it could be my cat. I don't know. But someone says 1 year from now, Apple would be $171.41, we think. So in other words, the 1 year capital gain yield estimate. Remember, this is just an estimate. This is not God's gospel. It's just we're saying they are thinking that it would be 171.41 minus 162.02 divided by 162.02. In other words, your sell price in 1 year minus your buy price, so this would be your absolute gain, divided by what you bought it at, that would be your percentage gain. And if I were to paw that out just real quick here, they're saying 171.41 minus 162.02, I should have used parentheses there, divided by 162.02. Ooh, that's actually not a good yield. 5.80%. I always round to two decimal places for this class. Actually, in my own work, I do too. That's a 1 year capital gain yield. Now I can actually now figure out the total gain, the total yield. I can say, all right, it's the dividend yield. What was that, 1.55% plus the capital gain yield, 5.80%. So that would be 7.35%. That is actually not a spectacular thing. For a beta of 1.43, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. If you're taking a nosebleed risk of 1.43, well, that's not nosebleed, but that's pretty high. I would kind of expect a little bit better than that, but there you go. That's what the projection is for Apple. Taking a pretty serious risk and getting a total yield between your gain on sale and your dividend that you're going to get of 7.35%, that's not really all that great. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, they'd have to be on future. I wouldn't be interested in the past. See, there's one of the interesting things is that right now, Apple has been barking and all that about its iPhone, promo everywhere. If I were to look at, let's say, a 1 year on Apple stock, I mean, for all the hype that Apple has done, see all this up here? That was hype. Now that more is known about it, I mean, it's not really a spectacular climb. Part of that's because there is disappointment with the Apple iPhone. There's significant competition from Android device-based devices. It's all there. And this is the market's best assessment. Millions of traders, insane amounts of information coming into these traders. This is wrong. Well, whatever, it's the best of the best deciding this, and if you want to buck it, by all means, you might be smarter than the market. Who knows? But this is the market's assessment. Nothing spectacular going on here. Let me show you quickly just another company. I mentioned Kroger. I think I'll do Kroger here just so you can see. Is there some reason why that didn't do that? Okay. Why is this behaving so slow? I mean, do I need to plug this in to make it actually do something? What the heck? Well, let me draw. Maybe I should use another. Oh, I'm using Chrome. That's the problem. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Kroger was KR. I apologize. I think Kellogg is K. Kellogg is K. Kroger is KR. Okay. Now you're seeing another screen. This is called screen analysis, by the way. I'm showing you how to do financial analysis. On Tuesday, I showed you looking at financial statements. Today, I'm showing you, I'm doing ratios here, and I'm slipping them in on you one at a time, so you know that there's a reason why we do it. It's not enough to just say, here's a formula, do this calculation. I want you to know why we're doing these formulas, what they mean in your lives and in your professional careers, possibly, since you'll all major in finance after having me, or not. Okay, look. This is the previous close. It came down a couple of pennies on the open. In other words, maybe a little bit of nothing. I wouldn't even worry about a couple of pennies. The bid-ask spread, these are thickly traded stocks, so your bid-ask spread is going to be modest on these, and it's lagging. This is lagging this one, by the way. That's why you see that odd thing there. The day's range, I mean, what do you got there? A spectacular 43 cents of movement. That's a little bit of a bouncy, but okay, now. I am glad I used Kroger. Okay. Sir, talk to me. Look at your 52-week range and the price today. Where are we? Are we close? We're close to the bottom, okay? It's not at the bottom, but it's close to the bottom. So this is one where the security is testing the neckline at the bottom of it. And as I can see, it certainly has not broken through that neckline at all. So this is another one. This one, they're barking from the top of the mountain at the valley below, but they haven't gone down and seen how deep the valley could get. So in this case, we have a stalk we would keep an eye on to see it testing its neckline, see if it can get down below it, how close it can get. If it breaks through it, that's a sell. If it doesn't break through it on three or four tries, then that would tell me that it ain't going to break that neckline. In my analysis, and again, I am not giving you any investment advice, but in my analysis, I don't think Kroger is anywhere near a bad stock. It has had some dings to its in the market with some bad numbers that came out, but at the same time, it has an aggressive plan for expanding and for refurbishing its stores to be superstores. Kroger is at least not like JCPenney. Kroger recognized that their stores were still old and old-fashioned and dingy, the store your mom and grandma went to. And if they're going to compete against the big box retailers, they're going to have to go big box. Walmart, maybe, but more likely Kroger is going to go head-to-head. A better competitor to compare it to would be Hy-Vee or Giant Eagle or something like that. But anyway, again, you can't tell much about the volume today. So, market cap on this one, $20.42 billion. Really quick here, I'm going to do something. SEC.gov, this is where you find the financial statements, okay? This is where you go to get information that someone might ask about on a quiz. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Fast search. I know its trading symbol, KR. So I'm going to find the 10K. There's the 10K right there. Interactive data. Financial statements. I'm not going to download the one this time. I'm just going to pull up the consolidated statement of operations and try to make the screen a little bigger. Oh, I do wish they wouldn't have done that. They did it by quarters. Seriously? 12 months ended. There it is, clear there at the back. Let me look at the balance sheet real quick here. Consolidated balance sheet. Okay, and again, they used to give us more years of data, but I want to point out something. See this number down here? This is the accounting value of the equity position, $6.71 billion. This is the market's assessment of the value of the equity, $20.042 billion. Again, notice what the accounting numbers say. The total book value, this is called book. This is book value, or we call it book. Book on the equity is $6.7 billion. Market cap on the equity is $20.042. The number of shares outstanding times the price per share. You have to make a decision. If you're going to do analysis or investing, think about it this way. You go to the local weather radar. It says there are no storms in the forecast. Skies will be sunny today. You then look at what everyone else is looking at, and you all agree, oh, that's Hurricane Irma. You look back at your forecast that's written down by meteorologists who burned out from being accountants. And they say, sunny skies. Then you look up again with all these other people who are assessing it. Yep, that's Irma. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, okay? Now, who are you going to believe? Those good accountants or your lying eyes? I would. Seriously. If you don't believe the accountants, you know what they can do? They can have hurt feelings. They can kick your shin or your ankle if they're midgets. Okay? I actually got in trouble last semester because I was disrespecting midgets. My God. Okay? Seriously, noob. Look, the point here is look up at the sky. Look at what the market is saying, because that is where your fortune will be made or broken. Not in numbers that were driven by rules. It will be in what the markets tell you about the situation. Okay? That's why we have to look at markets in finance. We use the accounting numbers, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, if the market can tell us something, then we listen to it. Because that's where we're going to make our money or lose our money, is in the market, not on the sheets. Go.
Is there anything you can tell about a business by the ratio or difference between the market cap and the book value?
Okay, market to book. There are these technical analysts that are still around. We call them elves. Technical analysts are called elves. I did do a lot of elf work, but I'm also a fundamental analyst. I look beyond numbers. Market to book. In other words, the market cap divided by the book value. Supposedly, you can learn something from that. The larger that number is. In other words, the bigger the market cap is relative to the book value, the more the healthier the company is. One part of that I do believe in. The market to book, for a company that is older, a company that is more established, the closer market to book is to one or below one, the more worried I get. In other words, if the market cannot sustain a value of the equity position that is even what's on the books, that is a bad sign. You follow with me what I'm saying here? Again, there is this one of the financial ratios called the market to book, and I think, I'm not sure if they still put that in this edition of your textbook. Market to book is your market cap divided by total shareholders' equity on the balance sheet. The bigger this is, supposedly the healthier the company is. The more it has pulled away from where it started. You see, that book value is what the stock sold at, plus the book value of earnings that have built up since the stock was sold. That's what the accounting number, the total shareholders' equity is. It's how much this money the company took in for the stock it sold, plus any added earnings that survived minus dividends to the balance sheet. So the farther that is away from one, the more this company has grown up. But the company, if a company is somewhat older and the market to book is still relatively close to one, or if it's below one, that means this company couldn't even survive and grow enough to give the shareholders more than they put into the company. That's a bad sign. So, for example, real quick here, I'm kind of curious about this one myself. I want to do something here. I want to add a tab and go back to SEC.gov and do check something out real quick here. Filings. I didn't want to do that. Oh, come on, I clicked the wrong one. What's Sears Holding Company? Finance.yahoo.com. Real quick here. Okay, I'm going to look at Sears here real quick, find its trading symbol. Yeah, Sears Holding, SHLD. Sears Holding. Oh God, that's sad. Okay. Let me see, it's 10K. Boy, I hope they used a lot of red ink for this. Okay. Financial statements, balance sheet, statement of operations, consolidated balance sheet. Okay. Total shareholders' equity. Total shareholders' equity. Really? Do they even write down the... Oh, totals. Oh, ew. Those are parentheses. Those are not good. And there are a lot of zeros in those parentheses. That's very not good. Wow. So in a case like this, you can't even calculate market to book. This company is, essentially, this company is dead. Wow. Ouch. Moving away from that, those kind of companies are scary. No, this isn't a great buy. I don't care if it's a dollar a share. Do not. Anyway, really quick here, back with Kroger, looking at the 1 year. Notice that Kroger has, see its neckline there? See the bottom right there? You see that? It's testing the bottom. It had a steep drop off. Wow. Yeah, that was an earnings estimate. This is a company I am certainly not in a sell position yet on this. But I, you know, you gotta have to watch carefully because its neckline is right there and it is sniffing that neckline hard. I don't think it's gonna break it simply because Kroger is still a fundamentally good company. And that's where fundamental analysis comes in. Sometimes you just have to say, what's the company's real position? This is a company with a strong, massive asset base. It's a company that still has a lot of customer loyalty. It's a company that's showing that it is at least willing to take the risks necessary to modernize it for the 21st century competitive environment. So right now, I would say I'm holding on this stock. But if it breaks that neckline, you're going to see me hiding behind the sofa barking like a poodle. Mm. And again, you can see the rest of it. Look at the beta. High risk or low risk stock? Talk to me. High risk or low risk? Bingo. I mean, this is a very safe stock. And the PE ratio in this case definitely is coordinate with that. And coordinating with and consistent with that safe. That, see that PE ratio? That is pretty, that's a little high. I shouldn't say that. Yeah, I was looking at that. I thought that was a 3.45. Yeah, the PE ratio is a little bit riskier there. You know, it's going to be one of those things that happens. Anyway, so we've got a dividend, and it's a 2.23% dividend. I mean, if it keeps paying that dividend, you buy the stock at that price, and you're going to get a 50 cent a share dividend. That's a heck of a lot better than you get in a savings account at a bank. So there, right there, even if I don't see much in the way of a capital gain, I mean, I'm curious what they're, just real quick here, they're projecting $26.09 in a year. So if I were to take $26.09 minus, what was their stock price again? $22.43, close the parentheses, and then divide that by 22.43. The market, or at least this estimate, is saying, oh, look at that. That's a 16% return in the capital gain. So you put together a 16.32% return with the dividend yield, which was 2.23%, geez, that's an 18.5% return on Kroger. I mean, that's not anything, that's not slouching at all. And that's unusually high for a beta, a stock with a beta of 0.3. So this might be a stock to keep an eye on. Again, be cautious. Look for it to find its way through that neckline. But if things go well and it doesn't break it, that's a hellaciously decent return on a very low beta stock for the time being. This is how we do financial analysis. It doesn't take a lot of calculus, but it just takes some a calculator and looking at the financials. Now, I'm going to quickly go through some financial ratios with you here. I might as well just, I've got Kroger up here, so. This is Kroger, yeah, Kroger, okay. First things first, I went through a couple of these with you before, and all of these are on a formula sheet that's available to you. You can get it laminated and show it off to people. Again, I would be interested in measuring the percent changes. And on a quiz, I would ask you, all right, what are the year-over-year percent changes? You notice here that it's pretty obvious that they had a very slow growth from fiscal 15 to fiscal 16. But then that growth accelerated in fiscal 17. I would want to check the percentage changes. For example, 109.83 minus 108.46 divided by 108.46. See what that change is. And then compare that. But I'm very sure Kroger's growth has accelerated in sales. Now, is that translating to the bottom line? I could very quickly go down here and check net earnings to the Kroger company and see if there's still growth, and there's not. Do you see that? It was growing, net earnings was growing positively in from 15 to 16, but net earnings dropped in 16 to 17. So in other words, even though sales were growing aggressively, earnings turned the other way at the end, in the last, from fiscal 16 to fiscal 17. Is there a reason why that would not be as, it looks bad? Ma'am, can you tell me a reason why it might not be as bad as it looks? Clearly, sales went up, earnings went down. So apparently there was some problem with cost control somewhere in there. Why might I not get all kinds of sad for that? Can you think of any reason? Why would I not get sad? If a company's earnings, its sales went up, but its earnings went down. So clearly, somewhere in the middle of that income statement, something went south. That's a problem. I'm going to be fussy at them for this, but I might not be as worried as some people might think I should be.
There might be something with the expenses that you can change.
Talk to me about that.
If you can figure out kind of where your costs went wrong company-wise.
Well, you could look at it and see, is there one place where costs lost control? That would certainly be an issue. Let me put it to you another way. Possibly a positive. Okay, you're going to get your first job when you graduate. You are going to get a spectacular, exciting job for $30,000 a year. Right? I know. That's a good time to roll. So you have your budget, and you're paying your SAD bills, and you're living in mom's basement, and all that. And then you get a call. Ring, ring, hello. Hi, I saw your profile on LinkedIn, and we would like to give you a job at $50,000 a year. We'd like to have you come in for an interview. Be sure to look professional. This is a professional job. Are your costs after that phone call going to be the same as your costs before that phone call? No, they're not. You're going to go out and you're going to buy like a maniac. You're going to be buying like zombies at a brain store. Okay? You know, that's kind of an interesting. There's an idea for a business. No. Okay, look. The point is that sometimes, if you are especially in a position like Target was, Target was, you might see that you are going to have to spend more money to make more money. And you might even have to spend disproportionately more money in the short run in order to make lots more money in the long run. Sometimes we will see a company, it's going to have to make a jump into the 21st century. It's going to have to realign itself for a new competitive world. It's going to have to do lots of things. And at first, there is some payoff, yes, but that payoff might not pace in the short run what you're going to have to spend to keep that payoff happening year over year. Target got heavily criticized because it lost earnings strength because it spent like a blind trout to upgrade all of its stores. Have you been into a Target in the last couple of... Do you remember Target back in the old days? And now you go in there, you can even buy yuppie food in there. You can buy those Keurig K-Cups. You can buy stuff that you don't need. The idea there being that Target spent more. Its earnings were going... Its sales went up. It was drawing... It was... still targeting you, but it was also getting into the world of tracking its demographic. In other words, you will graduate. You will move on. They want to keep you a customer of theirs as well as catch the next generation of college students. So to do that, they had to spend a lot of money to upgrade their stores, and their sales went up, but it didn't go up nearly as much as the cost of getting that done. But in the long run, Target is a survivor. Now it's got the stores, it's spent the cost, and now the sales will be reflected down in the net income line better. That's what this might be about. Kroger is clearly signaling that it's going to upgrade its stores to superstores. It's going to slowly wipe out those sad old Kroger. Do you go up that Kroger up there on Empire Emerson? Yeah, I mean, I go in there just, you know, it's weird. You got bad people go in there. I mean, people from Illinois Wesleyan go in there, for God's sake. I shouldn't have said that. No. It's a great school. You should have kept me on the faculty. Anyway, the bottom line, though, is that, yeah, they've lost room. Now, very quickly, just to make sure you know, I showed you these the last time. Gross margin is simply, and you've got... Here's the thing. You see it again? Most companies do not put in the gross margin, the gross income line. I'm going to download the Excel sheet here real quick. And then I'm going to be wandering around in it trying to find the... Why is everything happening so slowly today? Did it actually...
No, it's already downloaded.
Really? Down here? Oh, this is Chrome. I hate Chrome. No, seriously, Chrome is Google's. Google is a snoopy company. They look at everything you do. I don't want them to see where I go on the internet. Not that I go any place. Well, that one, you know, Betty Crocker site is kind of racy. Okay, there's your balance sheets. Consolidated statement of income. Oh, there we go. There's the 12 months. Let me make the sheet bigger. Well, I can't make it that big. Okay, now, again, they used to put a line in, but you're going to have to always really insert this line called gross income. I don't know why they don't anymore. It's just your sales minus your cost of sales equals your sale. Oops, I didn't want to do it there. Equals your sales line minus your cost of sales line. Sales minus cost of sales. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to drag that with the copy thing. Okay, there we go. Now, this is their gross income. In other words, retail minus wholesale before your your expenses you can't count to anything else. And so my curiosity with great gross margin would be how many pennies on every dollar survive wholesale prices. And so just out of just for one, I would take for the gross margin equals that divided by the gross income divided by the sales. Oh, that was, that's a bad number. You don't want a zero. Format the cells. Okay, and I want a percentage. Make it a percentage, make it to two decimal places. That'll be enough for anything I'd ask for. Be careful, though, with Pearson's online stuff. Sometimes they ask for a lot more. So in other words, my gross margin for the most recent fiscal year is 22.4%. Put in common terms, 22 cents of every dollar that came into the cash register survived paying for that merchandise that you sold. You know, whatever that's worth. Now, the next one that would be in the same ballpark, the next one that I would be might be interested in would be the operating profit. Now, I want to point out to you, operating profit can also be called operating income. Like I said, they use different names. There's no standard. And it could also be called EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. They're the same thing. And I just wish there was some kind of a comprehensive on this. Some kind of a rule, but they're all the same thing. Now, this one here is called your operating margin. Your operating margin. And this one is nothing but, and I'm going to do it for 17 again. I'm going to take this number divided by this number. And that, ouch. Whoa. That's a little bit scary, because what I'm looking at there, just a little less than 3 cents survived paying wholesale and survived paying your operating expense, your light bills and all that kind of stuff, your wages and salaries. That's a little bit worrisome. That right there kind of tells me where that, why that lost all that ground. I'm just curious about something. Let me do something. I'm going to copy this and see what the year before was. Yeah. See how, where the expenses went up were in operating expenses, wages and salaries, current value of marketing, current depreciation, things like that. Yeah. That's what hurt that bottom line was operating expenses went up. See how their operating margin was higher in fiscal 2016, and it dropped in fiscal 2017. Just curious where it was before. Yeah, that was when Kroger was still struggling. But clearly what happened with net income was mostly the result of, as you had noted before, it was operating expenses. Something in their operations. Okay, now the last one in the profitability ratios. Profitability ratios. The next one that I would want to see is their net income stuff. Okay, the net income, and again, these ratios are for you to, you can get these. Go over here to your net income, net earnings. Go find the whole shebang. Okay, look at the last line that's the big number. Net earnings attributable to Kroger. And if you take that number divided by your sales, equals that, I'm going to do 17. That divided by that, you're going to get, that is how many pennies of every dollar in sales that survived to belong to the shareholders. That is the residual claim per dollar of sales that the shareholders get. They can get it in dividends or plow back. That'll make the stock price grow. But one way or the other, these shareholders have a net margin of only 1.7 cents per share. Ouch. But again, you can't say that until you look at the industry. What is happening in the industry? What's happening with this company? Very quickly, I want to bring up one here, the times interest earned. The times interest earned is how many times over the earnings before interest and taxes can pay the debt holders what's due to them in the current period. Times interest earned. It is EBIT over interest expense. The closer it is to one, the scarier it gets, because if it goes below one, the company is dead. That's a favorite question of mine. What is the number for times interest earned that is a rock bottom? Or something along that line, I could ask. And in this case, just for a quick reference, the times interest earned, where's income? Okay, earnings before interest, okay. Operating and interest expense. So these two lines. So what I would do is I would go over here. Did I screw up? Oh, yeah, okay. I'll have to do it on the next slide. I'll just do operating equals that divided by that. I did that wrong. Let me do it again. Equals that over that. That's a 6.5. In other words, what they have to pay their prior claim debt holders is 6.5 times as much as they have to have. That's pretty healthy. They might be able to leverage a little more with a little more debt, but hard to say. A couple of last ones that are really important. Go to your balance sheet. Really? ROA and ROE. These are the biggies. Return on assets and return on equity. Return on assets is net income divided by total assets. ROE is net over total book equity. It would really be better if you use market cap to do this, but, you know, there you are. ROA is how much return you're getting off all of the company's assets. Those assets are an investment. What is that asset creating year over year in terms of a return? The ROE is how much are your shareholders' dollars returning. And so if I were to do that, you can do it a lot of different ways on these sheets, but what I would probably do is for ROA, and these are for 17, I would take for ROA, I would take equals the net income, which was right here, divided by the total assets right here. That's a pathetic number. That's a kind of a scary low number, but that might be standard for the industry. In other words, a 5.41% return on assets. For ROE, that would equal the net income I lost it there. ROE. There it is. The ROE that divided by the total shareholders' equity, which is clear down here. Total shareholders' equity, total equity right there. Oh, that's a decent number. Did I do that right? That's a decent number. That's a 23% return on the shareholders' money. The assets are not doing so well, but that's not bad for the shareholders' equity. Anyway, I would recommend that you hold on for a second here. That's all I have for you. I thank you.